And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, yesterday was the Ides of March. And in the Roman calendar, today is the Ides of March. It's March 15th, 74th day of the year. 291 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in history, in 474 BC, Roman consul Gnaeus Manlius Vulso celebrates an ovation for concluding the war with Veli and getting a 40 years truce. In 44 BC, Julius Caesar was assassinated by his friends. I guess today is the Ides of March. Yesterday was Pi Day. In 493 AD, Odoacer, the first barbarian king of Italy after the fall of the Western Roman Empires, slain by Theodoric the Great, king of the Ostrogoths. The two kings were feasting together, and Theodoric apparently took offense at something Odoacer said. 856 AD, Michael III, Emperor of the Byzantine Empire, overthrows the regency of his mother, Empress Theodora, wife of Theophilus, with the support of the Byzantine nobility. In 897, Al-Hadi Illa Il-Haq Yahya enters Sada and founds the Zadi Emanate of Yemen. 933, after a 10-year truce, German King Henry the Fowler defeats the Hungarian army at the Battle of Riadi near the Unstrut River. 1311, Battle of Palmiels. The Catalan Company defeats Walter V, Count of Brienne, to take control of the Duchy of Athens, a crusader state in Greece. 1564, Mughal Emperor Akbar abolishes the jizya tax on the non-Muslim subjects. 1672, King Charles II of England issues the Royal Declaration of Indulgence, granting limited religious freedom to all Christians. 1783, in an emotional speech in Newburgh, New York, George Washington asks his officers not to support the Newburgh conspiracy. The plea is successful and the threatened coup d'etat never takes place. Now, the Newburgh conspiracy was an apparent military coup by the Continental Army in March of 1783, at the very end of the American Revolutionary War. The conspiracy was probably instigated by members of the Congress of the Confederation, who sent around an anonymous letter in the army camp at Newburgh, New York. Soldiers were unhappy they hadn't been paid for some time, and the pensions had been promised remain unfunded. And the letter suggested they should take unspecified action against Congress to resolve the issue. It said that the letter was written by Major John Armstrong, aide to General Horatio Gates, although the authorship and the ideas expressed in the letter are subject of historical debate. George Washington, of course, as I said, stopped the whole thing. Not long afterward, Congress approved a compromise agreement that it had previously rejected, funded some of the pay that was due, and granted soldiers 5 years of full pay instead of a lifetime pension at half pay. All righty. 1848. Revolution breaks out in Hungary. The Habsburg rulers are compelled to meet the demands of the Reform Party. 1874, France and Vietnam signed the Second Treaty of Saigon, further recognizing the full sovereignty of France over Cochin China. In 1875, Archbishop of New York, John McCloskey, is named the first cardinal in the United States. 1877, the first ever official cricket test match is played. Australia versus England at the MCG Stadium in Melbourne, Australia. 1878, restoration of the Scottish Catholic hierarchy, broken off back in 1603. 1888 started the Anglo-Tibetan War of 1888. 1916, Woodrow Wilson sends 4,800 U.S. troops over the U.S.-Mexican border to pursue Pancho Villa. Now, for those that are not familiar with what I've said about this, I was in one of the units that in those days had been sent after Villa. It was the 20th Infantry, which was stationed in the Panama Canal Zone. And there was a lot of records there, plus a photographic history. When I moved here to El Paso, I met a gentleman who was, he was probably in his 80s at that time. And he had been, he had lied about his age, gone in the Army at 15, and served as Pershing's, they called him Batman in those days. Basically, it was a enlisted servant. And he went with Pershing into Mexico. And he said the story about it being a dangerous escapade was over-exaggerated. He said in the evening, Villa and his senior officers would come down from the hills and they'd play cards because Villa and Pershing were good friends. In fact, when Pershing's family was killed at the Presidio in San Francisco, one of the first people to show up at the Pershing house at Fort Bliss was Pancho Villa. And if you ever went into the Pershing house, hanging on the wall behind the front door were photographs of Villa and Pershing sitting on the front porch of the Pershing house. Pershing was down here. Many thought he commanded Fort Bliss. He did not. He was here checking the lay of the land. This whole thing was done to let us test new equipment under wartime conditions. Pretty much that's what was done as he chased Villa across Mexico. The whole thing was a put-up job, according to what I was told. In 1917, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia abdicates the Russian throne, ends the 304-year Romanov dynasty. 1921, Talat Pasha, former Grand Vizier of the Ottoman Empire and chief architect of the Armenian Genocide, is assassinated in Berlin by a 23-year-old Armenian by the name of Soghoman Delirian. 1922, after Egypt gains nominal independence from the UK, Fuad I becomes King of Egypt. 1926, the dictator Theodoros Pangelos is elected president of Greece without any opposition. If you ran against him, he got shot. So pretty much that determined there wasn't going to be any opposition. 1927, the first women's boat race between the University of Oxford and the University of Cambridge takes place on the Isis in Oxford. 1931, the SS Viking explodes off Newfoundland. 27 of the 147 on board are killed. 1933, Austrian Chancellor Engelbert Dollfuss keeps members of the National Council for convening, starting the Austro-Fascist dictatorship. 1939, Germany occupies Czechoslovakia. That same year, Carpatho, Ukraine declares itself an independent republic. But the day after that declaration, they were annexed by Hungary. 1941, Philippine Airlines enters service, making airline the first and oldest commercial airline in Asia, operating under its original name. 1943, World War II, the Third Battle of Kharkov. Germans retake the city of Kharkov from the Soviet armies in bitter street fighting. Man for man, the German army was probably the best in Europe. 1945, World War II. Soviet forces begin an offensive to push Germans from Upper Silesia. 1951, Iranian oil industry is nationalized. 1952, in Solanos, Reunion, 73 inches of rain falls in a 24-hour period, setting a new world record, March 15th through the 16th. 1961, at the 1961 Commonwealth Prime Ministers Conference, South Africa announces it will withdraw from the Commonwealth when the South African Constitution of 1961 comes into effect. 1961, President Lyndon Johnson, responding to the Selma crisis, tells U.S. Congress we shall overcome while advocating the Voting Rights Act. He would have sold his mother to remain in power. 1974, 15 people are killed when Sterling Airways Flight 901, a Sud Aviation Caravelle, catches fire following a landing gear collapse at the Mirabad International Airport in Tehran, Iran. 1978, Somalia and Ethiopia sign a truce to end the Ethio-Somali War. 1986, collapse of Hotel New World. 32 people die when the New World Hotel in Singapore collapses. 1990, Mikhail Gorbachev is elected the first president of the Soviet Union. 1991, Cold War. The treaty on the final settlement with respect to Germany comes into effect, granting full sovereignty to the Federal Republic of Germany. 2008, stockpiles of obsolete ammunition explode at an ex-military ammunition depot in the village of Serdak in Albania. 26 people are killed in the explosion. 2011, beginning of the Syrian civil war. 2019, 51 people are killed in the Christchurch mosque shootings. 2019, beginning of the 2019-2020 Hong Kong protest. In 2019, approximately 1.4 million young people in 123 countries go on strike to protest climate change. And of course, climate ignored them. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances: Christian Feast Day, Clement Mary Hofbauer, Lucretia, St. Longinus, Louise de Morlick, Constitution Day in Belarus, National Day, celebrating the Hungarian Revolution of 1848 in Hungary, World Consumer Rights Day internationally, and in Palau, Youth Day. All right. Probably one of the most famous assassinations in history was that of Julius Caesar in 44 BC. He was stabbed to death by Brutus, Cassius, and several other Roman senators on the Ides of March in Rome. 221 AD, Liu Bei, a Chinese warlord member of the Han royal house, declares himself emperor of Shu Han, claiming legitimate succession to the Han dynasty. 351, Constantinus II elevates his cousin Gallus to Caesar and puts him in charge of the eastern part of the Roman Empire, which became Byzantium. 933 AD, the Battle of Riyadh. German King Henry I beats the Magyars. 1311, Battle of Hamyos. The Catalan Company defeats Walter V. I talked about that. 1360, French attack the English south coast, raiding Winslow Sea. 1382, conservative Popolo Grasso regains power in Florence, Italy. 1391, an anti-Semitic monk in Seville, Spain, stirs up people to attack Jews. 1493, Christopher Columbus returns to Spain after his first voyage to the New World. 1526, French Dauphin, that's the successor to the throne of France. Francis and his brother Henry are exchanged as hostages for their father, Francis I. Begins 4 years of captivity in Spain under the Treaty of Madrid. 1560, there was a failed assault on the royal palace in Amboise in France. 1562, General Francois de Guise enters Paris. 1580, Spanish King Philip II puts a $25,000 reward on the head of Prince William of Orange. I don't think he liked him much. 1729, Sister St. Stanislaus Heckard, the first American nun, takes her vows in New Orleans. 1744, French King Louis the 15th declares war on Britain. 1778, Nootka Sound, Vancouver Island, discovered by Captain James Cook. 1781, Battle of Guilford Courthouse. British troops under Cornwallis defeat American troops, but their heavy losses led to ceding of territory and a strategic loss. The American commander was General Nathaniel Greene. 1812, the first Russian settlement is established in California at the Russian River. 1820, Maine is admitted as the 23rd state. 1827, University of Toronto is chartered. 1848, revolution breaks out in Hungary. The Habsburg rulers are compared to make concessions. 1855, Louisiana establishes the first health board in the country to regulate a quarantine. 1862, General John Hunt Morgan begins 4 days of raids near Gallatin, Tennessee. 1867, Michigan becomes the first state to tax property to support a university. 1869, the Cincinnati Red Stockings becomes the first professional baseball team. 1887, the first salaried fish and game warden was in Michigan. His name was William Alden Smith. 1889, six U.S. and German warships are sunk by a typhoon in Alpha Harbor in Samoa. 200 die. 1892, the first escalator is patented by inventor Jesse Reno in New York City. 1892, New York State unveils the first automatic ballot booth. We call it a voting machine. 1906, Britain's Rolls Royce and Johnston formed the company Rolls Royce Limited. 1907, Finland is the first European country to give women a right to vote. 1913 was the first U.S. press conference, presidential press conference, Woodrow Wilson. 1913, Cleveland establishes the first small claims court. 1916, the Dutch merchant ship Tubantia, torpedoed by a German submarine, and sinks in the North Sea. 1916, University of Ghent taken under Dutch control. 1916, when I mentioned that Nicholas II, the last Russian Tsar, had abdicated on this date, he nominated his brother, Grand Duke Michael, to succeed him. That didn't go over too well. 1919, the American Legion is formed in Paris. 1922, France, which up until this date in 22 had insisted on currency for all World War I reparation payments from Germany, now agrees to accept raw materials as payment. On this date in 1923, Vladimir Lenin had his third stroke. 1926, this was Belgium's Black Monday, and the franc collapsed. 1930, the first seaplane glider is flown at Port Washington, New York. 1930, the first streamlined submarine of the U.S. Navy, the USS Nautilus, is launched. 1933, the NAACP begins coordinated attack on segregation and discrimination. 1937, the first American blood bank and a hospital is opened at Cook County Hospital in Chicago. 1937, the first state contraceptive clinic is opened in Raleigh, North Carolina. On his date in 1939, Adolf Hitler summons Czech President Emil Hácha to a meeting in Berlin, and
informs him that Germany is going to attack Czechoslovakia. Hacha suffers a heart attack and surrenders. In 1940, Hermann Goering says 100 to 200 church bells are enough for Germany. Smelts the rest and makes weapons. Okay. In 1951, Persia nationalizes the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And that company made a lot of fortunes for a lot of folks. All right, I think we've pretty much come to the end of this history session. We've been talking about creatures of the night. We're going to talk about some more of them today. We talked about the River Ness Monster. How about the Salamis River Monster? It was October 1907. A remarkable, terrifying encounter with a water monster occurred on the Salamis River in Brazil. German explorer and adventurer Franz Hermann Schmidt, along with a companion, Captain Rudolf Flegg, spent weeks exploring the wild areas of Colombia in search of all things wild and wonderful. And they did find at least one of them. 12 days into their trek along the Salamis River, Smith, Fling, and their Indian guides, visited a remote valley that was filled with a thick vegetation and fed by a small, shallow lake. The entire team was excited, but also disturbed to see a large number of huge tracks leading to and from the lake. And those tracks they couldn't recognize as any type of known creature. In addition, it was evident that whatever left the tracks had been feeding on the leaves of certain trees that extended to heights of about 14 feet. In other words, this was a good-sized creature. The next day, something amazing occurred. As Smith, Fling, and their guides negotiated the waters of the lake in canoes, a certain loud crashing and splashing was heard from the direction of thick vegetation on the bank. The guides, seeming having some pre-existing awareness that the creature lurked just out of sight, panicked and paddled their canoes away from the edge and toward the central portion of the lake. According to Smith, in his journal, there was a sudden outcry among the monkeys, and a large dark something half hidden among the branches shot up among them, and there was a great commotion. One of the excited Indians began to paddle the boat away from the shore, and before we could stop him, we were 100 feet from the waterline. Now we could see nothing, and the Indians absolutely refused to go closer to the shore. And neither Flinger himself cared to lay their rifles down in order to take up the paddles. There's a great waving of plants and the sound like heavy slaps of a great paddle mingled with the cries of some of the monkeys. They were moving rapidly away from the lake. One or two that were hurt or held fast were shrieking, and then their cries stopped. For a full 10 minutes, there was total silence, and then the green growth began to stir again, and coming back to the lake, we saw this frightful creature. And frightful was the best word Smith could come up with. He said the head appeared over bushes that were 10 feet tall, about the size of a beer keg, shaped like that of a tapir, as if the snout was used for pulling things or taking hold of them. The eyes were small and dull and set in like those of an alligator. And despite the half-dried mud, they could see that the neck, which was snake-like, only thicker in proportion, was rough-knotted like an alligator's sides rather than his back. Evidently, the animal didn't see anything odd about Smith and his companions, if he noticed them at all, and advanced till he was not more than 150 feet away. We could see part of the body, he said, which he would judge to have been 8 or 9 feet thick at the shoulders, if that word can be used, since there were no forelegs, only some great heavy clawed flippers. The surface was like that of a neck. For a wonder, the Indians didn't bolt. They just seemed fascinated like everybody else. As far as Smith was concerned, he would have waited a little longer, but Fling threw up his rifle and fired at the head of the creature. And I'm sure he struck between the eyes, and the bullet must have struck something bony, horny, or very tough, or it cut twigs from a tree high up and further on after it glanced. Smith himself fired after Fling did and aimed for the base of the neck. And until that point, the animal remained perfectly still. It dropped its nose to the spot at which he'd aimed and seemed to bite at it, but there was no blood or any sign it had been hurt. As quickly as we could fire, we pumped 7 shots into it, and all of them seemed to hit. And they seemed to annoy the creature, but it didn't cause any great injury. And suddenly it plunged forward in a silly, clumsy fashion. The Indians nearly upset the dugout getting away, and both Fling and Smith missed sight of the creatures enter the water. Now, Smith was anxious, he said, to see its hind legs, if it had any. And he looked again, only in time to see the last of it leave the land, a heavy, blunt tail with rough, horny lumps. The head was still visible, though the body was hidden by the water. And from this instant's opportunity, I'd say the creature, he said, was about 35 feet long, with at least 12 of it devoted to head and neck. He said in 3 seconds there was nothing to be seen except the waves of the muddy water and the movements of the waterside growth, and a monkey with its hind parts uselessly hauling itself up on to a treetop. As the Indians paddled frantically away, he said, I put a bullet through the poor thing to let it out of its misery. He said they hadn't gone 100 yards before Fling called out to him and pointed to the right. Above the water, 1/8 of a mile away, appeared the head and neck of the creature. It must have dove and gone under him. After a few seconds' gaze, it began to swim toward us, and as the bullets didn't seem to have any effect, we took to flight. Losing sight of it behind an island, we didn't pick it up again and were just as well pleased that it disappeared. Now, whatever the true identity of the creature, it's still hidden today, just as it did to Smith and Fling back in 1907. And then, let's talk about St. Helena's sea serpents. Just located just outside of central London is a large and pressing building known as the National Archives. And it serves as a repository for both classified and declassified files from the British Royal Air Force, Royal Army, Navy, and the British equivalents of the FBI, CIA, Department of Defense, and National Security Agency. As might be expected, the bulk of the records the British government had released onto the public domain via the passing of its Freedom of Information Act and that are now available for scrutiny by the public focus upon such matters as Cold War activities, espionage, the Second World War, and the day-to-day work of governmental bodies. As well as the strictly down-to-earth material, intriguing files have surfaced, demonstrating that during the 19th century, elements of British officialdom took a deep and keen interest in sightings and on the high sea of nothing less than sea serpents. And one of the most notable reports of an encounter with such a beast can be found within the archives of the Admiralty. The documentation at issue details a remarkable encounter with a sea serpent that was seen March 9, 1830 by the crew of the Rob Roy, British Royal Navy ship that was homeward bound from after a lengthy sea journey across the Atlantic Ocean. As the ship sailed by the island of St. Helena, something remarkable occurred, as the Rob Roy's captain, James Stockdale, recorded in his official log. According to the log, at about 5 p.m., all at once, while I was walking on the poop, my attention was drawn to the water on the port bow by a scuffling noise. Likewise, all the watch on deck were drawn to that sound. And judge my amazement with what should stare us all in the face, as if not knowing whether to come over the deck or to go around the stern, was a great big sea snake. Now, I've heard of the fellow below, and I've killed snakes 24 feet long in the Straits of Malacca, but they had to go into this creature's mouth. I think he must have been asleep, for we were going along very softly at 2 knots an hour, and he seemed as much alarmed as we were, and all taken back for about 15 seconds. But he soon was underway, and when fairly off, his head was square with our topsail, and his tail was square with the foremast. He said, my ship is 171 feet long overall, and The foremast is 42 feet from the stern. And that would make the creature about 129 feet long. Now, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't believe it, he said, but there was no mistake or doubt about its length. Because the creature was so close, I could even smell his nasty, fishy smell. But underway, he carried his head about 6 feet out of the water with a fin between the shoulders about 2 feet long. I think he was swimming about 5 miles an hour, because I watched him from the topsail yard until I lost sight of him in about 40 or 50 minutes. I hope never to see him again. It was enough to frighten the strongest of hearts. Now, a second report of a sea monster sighting has been declassified at an official level by the British government and describes an extraordinary event on December 13, 1857. This encounter also occurred in the vicinity of the island of St. Helena. A statement prepared by Commander George Henry Harrington revealed a few other facts. He said, while myself and others were standing on the lee side of the poop, looking toward the island, we were startled by the sight of a huge marine animal that reared its head out of the water about 20 yards from the ship. When it suddenly disappeared for about half a minute and then made a reappearance in the same manner again, showed us its neck and head about 10 or 20 feet out of the water. Its head was shaped like a long buoy, and I should suppose the diameter would have been 7 or 8 feet in the largest part of with a kind of scroll or ruff encircling it about 2 feet from the top. The water was discolored for several hundred feet from the head, so much so that it first appeared, during its first appearance, my impression was the ship was in broken waters, produced, as I suppose, by some volcanic agency since I passed the island before. Harrington went on to say, by the second appearance, completely dispelled these fears and assured us it was a monster of extraordinary length and appeared to be slowly moving toward the island. Now, the ship was going too fast to enable us to reach the masthead in time to form a correct estimate of its extreme length, but from what we saw from the deck, we concluded it must have been over 200 feet long. The boatswain and several of the crew who observed it from the forecastle stated that it was more than double the length of the ship, in which case it must have been close to 500 feet. Captain went on to conclude his official report, and he said, I'm convinced this creature belonged to the serpent tribe. And it would seem that there's little doubt of that. Well, let's turn to Sweden. The fifth largest body of water in Sweden is the Storsjön Lake, and it has something in common with Loch Ness. A lake monster. Or maybe an entire colony of them. Its name is Storsjuret, and it's a creature with a long history. In 1635, a priest named Morgans Petersden wrote a report that suggests the Swedish Nessie is a beast of supernatural proportions rather than one of flesh and blood. According to what the priest wrote, a long, long time ago, two trolls, Jara and Kata, stood on the shores of the great lake brewing a concoction in their cauldrons. They brewed and mixed and added to the liquid for days and weeks and years. They didn't know what was going to result from their brew, but they wondered about it a great deal. One evening, there was heard a strange sound coming from one of the cauldrons. There was a wailing, a groaning, and a crying, and suddenly came a loud bang. A strange animal with a black serpentine body and a cat-like head jumped out of the cauldron and disappeared into the lake. Now, the creature enjoyed living in the lake, grew unbelievably larger and awakened terror among the people whenever it appeared. And finally, it extended all the way around the island of Frushen and could even bite its own tail. Kaido Runski bound the mighty monster with a strong spell that was carved on a stone and raised on the island of Frushen. The serpents pictured on the stone. Thus was the spell to be tied till the day somebody came along who could read and understand the inscription on the stone. 50 years later, in 1685, the monster was still attracting the attention of people in the region of Storsjön Lake. Andreas Plantin stated of the serpent of the deep, it said, beneath this stone lies a dreadfully large head of a serpent that the body stretches over Storsjön to Candida by and Hill Sand, where the tail is buried. The serpent's called a ray, and therefore shall this stone be risen. Since no one peacefully could cross Storsjön, the ferryman and his wife states, along with many others, that in the last turbulent times, this stone was torn down and broken in two. As long as the stone laid on the ground, many strange things occurred in the water until the stone was risen and reassembled anew. Now, the stone that Plantin was referring to was the Froso runestone. For those who may not know, runestones are ancient raised stones inscribed with runic symbols. That was the Storsjugeret. Has a connection to the Froso runestones, yet another indication that in times past, the beast was perceived as a paranormal creature. It's important to note that the Storsjugeret is not just a creature of the distant past. In the 1970s, a number of significant encounters took place with the creature. August 2nd, 1973, a man named Ragnar Bjorts had a notorious sighting of the monstrous creature. According to his report, I'm the fisheries officer in this area, and I was out checking to see that all the anglers had their valid permits. And instead of anglers, I saw something peculiar, a big tail that was about 0.5 meters high, just above the surface. First, I thought it was a piece of driftwood, but when I got closer, I saw a colossal fish whose tail was out of the water. Now, my boat was 3.8 meters long, and I estimate the fish was 2 meters longer than the boat. When I was by the side of the creature, I took my oar and hit it straight over its back. Well, by Bjork's own admission, yeah, I shouldn't have done that. In the same moment, the animal slapped the water with its tail, so the boat was thrown 3 to 4 meters into the air. Strangely enough, the boat came straight down on its keel, but I had to balance it. I believe God was with me then. As for the specific description of the creature, he said the creature was gray-brown on top, yellow underneath, and was 5 to 6 meters long. Now, I think it was a marl, a voracious predatory fish that grows over 16 feet long in some countries. It was a real experience, and many people would think that this Storsjugeret is a mere fake, but I've seen it with my own eyes, and I'm not afraid to talk about it. Some years ago, my wife saw it. It had two humps and was slowly moving forward. I didn't believe her then, but I believe her now. Also convinced was Rolf Larsen and Irene Magnusson, who saw the legendary monster 3 years after Ragnar Bjorks did. July 1976, when the pair, fishing on the lake at the time, had an extraordinary encounter. According to Larsen, we were about 500 meters from land. We were going home when we passed a buoy. Suddenly, some waves rocked the boat. 50, 60 meters from us, between land and the boat, we saw something that moved under the surface. It came up to the surface, not with a splash, but with smooth waves. Now, the part of the body we saw above water wasn't more than 20 or 30 centimeters high and about a meter long. But from the amount of water it displaced, we could see that it was a large object beneath the surface. I'd like to compare it with an upside-down boat. You only see the keel. Irene was as pale as a corpse. Well, like the Lusnex monster, Ogopogo and Champ, the Storsjugeret continues to be seen, even today. And just like the Big Three, it continues to elude capture and identification. So the mystery of Sweden's most famous monster still lives on. Then we have Tigi of Lake Bala. Deep in the heart of North Wales, there exists a large expanse of water called Lake Bala. And you might say there's nothing particularly strange about it. And you would be correct. Lake Bala is not out of the ordinary in the slightest. But what is rumored to dwell in its dark depths most assuredly is not ordinary. It's the domain of a violent lake monster called Tigi. Or maybe this story was born out of secret military experiments. All very much depends on who you ask and who you believe. It's worth noting, within Lake Bala, there works a creature called Gleniad. It's hard to be termed a monster. It's just a small fish. But there's one issue concerning the Gleniad that does have a bearing on the matter of Tigi. The Gleniad is a fish that dates back to prehistoric era and is found in Lake Bala and no place else. This has quite naturally given rise to a thought-provoking question. What else of a prehistoric nature might live in Lake Bala? And how big might it grow? You know, these are questions that need to be considered. Whereas sightings of the Loch Ness Monster date back more than 1,500 years, Lake Bala's resident unknown beast has only been reported for just over 100 years. Now, some locals who claim to have seen the tiggies at close quarters say the creature resembles a huge, violent northern pike. They're ferocious fish that can easily grow to 4 or 5 feet in length. And rumor has it, some even reach as high as long as 6 feet. But if the tiggies are northern pike, then they would have to be true giants, since witnesses claim that the creatures they encountered were in the order of 10 to 15 feet. Now, nobody needs telling that a too close encounter with such a creature would result in a swift and bloody death, though probably not for the tiggy. Then there are the equally baffling reports of a reptilian monster that vaguely resembles a crocodile. Such a scenario is unlikely, since as a colony of crocodiles would stand little chance of adapting to or surviving in harsh North Wales winter, never mind untold numbers of centuries of these winters. And there's, however, a third theory for what tiggy might be. And this theory is just as strange and controversial as the crocodile and northern pike scenarios, but in a little bit different fashion. There are long-standing rumors in and around the Bala area that in the build-up to the First World War, the British Royal Navy secretly let loose a group of seals into the lake. The reason for doing this was they're going to strap them with dynamite and train them to attack specific targets, namely enemy warships. It should be noted the dynamite wasn't real and the warships were just small rowing boats. In other words, this was a test run in the event the Royal Navy might find itself in a war with Germany, which it did in 1914 when the First World War broke out. And the suicidal seals strapped with explosives might be required to fight for their country. According to the story, the seals proved impossible to train and the project was abandoned. So today, what people are seeing are brief glimpses of the original seals that bred and bred and so on and so forth. Of course, it's possible this is nothing more than a tall tale passed on through generations without any actual facts to support it. And it has to be said, it'd be very difficult to mistake a seal for a crocodile or a huge violent pike. So the legend of Tiggy continues to thrive. The only question is, what exactly is Tiggy? Well, from lake monsters, let's talk about cryptic apes and wild men. We're going to start out talking about the Almasti. Now, it shouldn't be a surprise to learn that the vast wildernesses, thick forests, and massive mountain ranges of Russia are home to a Bigfoot-type creature. They're known to the locals as Almasti. And for some researchers, the creatures are unknown ape. For others, they're nothing less than still surviving pockets of Neanderthals. Both scenarios are amazing in terms of their potential implications. But whatever the true identity of the Almasti might be, there's very little doubt that the creature does exist. The sheer number of witness reports make this very clear. Now, the Almasti is a creature that has a long history attached to it, something that also adds to the likelihood of it being a genuine animal of very ancient proportions. Now, what's very possibly the earliest report on record of these hairy giant creatures comes from one Hans Schiltenberger. In the 1400s, Schiltenberger was taken prisoner by Turkish forces and, according to David Hatcher Childress, placed in the retinue of a Mongol prince by the name of Egedi. Now, it transpired that upon his return to Europe in 1427, he began writing a book about his experience with the Turks. And it was a book that surfaced in 1430 and was made highly notable by its reference to strange and savage creatures that Schiltenberger had been told about, which were said to live high in the Tian Shan Mountains of Mongolia, which, of course, borders Russia. According to Schiltenberger's words, the inhabitants say that beyond the mountains is the beginning of a wasteland that lies at the edge of the earth. Nobody can survive there because the desert is populated by so many snakes and tigers. And in the mountains themselves live wild people who have nothing in common with other human beings. They wear pelts instead of clothing. Only the hands and face are free of hair. And they run around in the hills like animals and eat foliage and grass and whatever else they can find. The lord of the territory made Igadi a present of a couple of forest people, a man and a woman. They'd been caught in the wilderness together with three untamed horses the size of asses and all sorts of other creatures that couldn't be found in German lands, and which I can't put a name to. Evidently, the creature still exists. In August of 2005, a Ukrainian newspaper named Situation describes a then recent encounter with no less than an entire group of Almasti on the Medizi Plateau in the Crimea. According to the newspaper, Ivan S., who was 21, and his group of 12 tourists were spending their second day camped on the plateau. The kids went to sleep early while the adults stayed up for a while. The night was very bright with a full moon, according to Crimean ufologist Anton Anfilov. According to Anfilov, Ivan's assistant Shasa and several of the men left the campsite to use the bathroom. When they came back, they looked terrified and they were trembling. And then everybody heard a frightful growl near the camp. Suddenly, the group was confronted by a pack of huge, they were about 8 feet tall, naked hairy men. Now, I would submit that if a bunch of naked hairy men showed up out of the bushes, they might look to be 10 feet tall. According to Sasha, there were three creatures. They're about 6 meters away from us. They were 2 to 2.5 meters in height. Their true height was hard to estimate because they're all crouched down and balancing themselves on their fists like huge apes. All three were growling at us, and their faces were hairy, almost without wrinkles, and their eyes weren't shiny at all. The heads were set or positioned very low as if they had no necks. And on their backs, they had something like humps on their spines. They were very aggressive. Everybody was scared, and the beast growls woke the children, who became hysterical. According to the newspaper report, the standoff lasted for about 45 minutes. Finally, as if on a signal, the creatures turned and bounded away with strange ape-like bouncing leaps. The campers spent a sleepless night around their campfire. In the morning, Ivan and the others searched the ground around the camp, but due to a dense layer of fallen leaves, the creature didn't leave any distinct prints. Then in 2009, in April of that year, the Russian newspaper Pravda had a story. It was entitled, "Russian Scientists Say Google Maps to Find Yeti." According to that story, there had been 20 sightings of Almasti by hunters in the forest of Kemerovo. Not only that, there are also reports of strange large footprints having been discovered in the depths of nearby caves. Scientists found two identical Yeti footprints. One was left on the rock, and it dates back 5,000 years. And the other footprint was left not long ago, as found at the bottom of the cave. Pravda spoke to one of the scientists who reported they're absolutely identical. 5,000 years ago, Yetis settled down in this cave, and now their descendants are still living there. And the conditions in the cave are certainly suitable for the Yeti. The cave defends them from rains and snow and wind, and there's a lake in the middle of the cave where they can get clean water. Unfortunately, the scientists didn't manage to see any Yetis that time. They said their snowmobiles were too noisy and the Yetis had hidden themselves somewhere in the forest. However, the scientists said they did manage to reach their main goal. They got proof the Yetis are living there, and they're going to send another expedition back. But that wasn't all, according to Pravda. Members of the Cosmopolsk Association returned from an expedition to Russia's Kirov region where they searched for a Bigfoot that allegedly lived in that region. Cosmopolsk leader Vadim Chernobrov says the expedition has discovered a den occupied by a mysterious giant in an underground passage dug obviously not by a human. Ivan Konovalov was a forest warden who for 30 years worked in the Kirov region. He had a 1985 encounter with the Almasti. He said, "It was snowing on the day that I was walking along the fir road and suddenly heard the snap of twigs. I turned around and saw an awesome creature covered with dark hair that was much taller than me, and it smelled." The creature leaned against a pine tree and started bending it down to the ground. The tree was rather thick, but it cracked under the creature's weight. Then the creature started breaking the tree against the knee. Its hands were thick and long as its legs. And quite of a sudden, the creature felt something and turned its face toward me. I saw two black eyes, and the impression at the bottom of the eyes deeply impressed me. I still remember the look the creature gave me, and it flung the tree aside and quickly left. I was absolutely thunderstruck, he said. Then we have the big gray man of Ben McDuey. Now, a large, mysterious mountain in the Scottish range called the Cairngorms, Ben McDuey is said to be the lair of a sinister, lumbering, Bigfoot-like creature known as the Big Gray Man. Legends about its existence date back centuries, and they show no signs of stopping. Although definitively animal-like in both nature and appearance, the big gray man reputedly possesses paranormal powers that allow it to plunge the unwary traveler into states of terror and panic. A form of monster-based mind control one might be justified in suggesting, but I would suggest that the mere appearance of something unusual like that might cause terror and panic. Without doubt, the foremost expert on the big gray man's anomalies expert, Andy Roberts. And Andy's noted that witnesses to the creepy phenomena describe how they heard heavy footsteps on the fog-shrouded mountain, felt a distinct sensation of a threatening presence, and experienced an overwhelming feeling of unbridled terror. Now, the experience is graphic enough to compel witnesses to run, in fear of their lives, to be frank, and in some cases to run wildly and in crazed, fear-filled fashion for miles. Taking into consideration the fact that encounters almost exclusively take place on rocky, dangerous ground and often in weather conditions involving mist and snow, Andy suggests we shouldn't underestimate the power of the experience. As far as can be determined, the first encounter of any real note with a big gray man occurred in 1791. The witness was a poet and shepherd named James Hogg. He reported seeing a massive figure on Ben McDuie that appeared to manifest out of a strange halo. According to Andy, as he watched the halo which had formed around him due to the combination of sunshine and mist, he suddenly noticed a huge looming figure. It was vaguely human in shape, and he imagined it to be the devil. Well, as you might expect, Hogg fled in terror, not stopping till he reached his fellow shepherds. And then from the year 1831, we got a following from Sir Thomas Dick Lowder. According to Sir Thomas, on descending from the top of Ben McDuie at about 3:30 p.m., an interesting optical appearance presented itself to our view. We had turned toward the east and the sun shone on our backs when we saw a very bright rainbow descend on the mist in front of us. The bow of beautifully distinct prismatic colors formed about two-thirds of a circle, the extremities of which appeared to rest on the lower portions of the mountain. In the center of this incomplete circle, there was described a luminous disc surrounded by the prismatic colors displayed in concentric rings. On the disc itself, each of the party, there were three, as they stood about 50 yards apart, saw his own figure almost distinctly delineated, although those of the other two were invisible to him. The representation appeared of natural size, and the outline of the whole person of the spectator was almost correctly portrayed. To prove that the shadow seen by each individual was out of himself, we resorted to various gestures, such as waving our hat and flapping our plaids. All those motions were exactly followed by the airy figure. And in 1921, the Cairngorm Club Journal reported that a recent letter writer called attention to a myth prevalent in the Upper Deeside to the effect that a big spectral figure had been seen at various times during the last 5 years walking about on the tops of the Cairngorms. Whenever they're approached, according to the story, the creature disappears. And then Andy Roberts added another layer to the puzzle. In 1924, Dr. Ernest Baker's book, The Highlands with Rope and Rucksack, appeared. Baker related the experience of a friend whose job took him into the mountains, a deer stalker or maybe a shepherd. Alone on Ben McDuie one day, became aware of a terrifying presence which Alfred Gray, the author of the book The Big Gray Man of Ben McDuie, recounted. The appearance disturbed him in a manner that was beyond his experience. Now, Gray made the point that this was no ordinary fear, but something so powerful that Baker's friend fled from Ben McDuie, the terror only subsiding when he reached low ground. Baker also reported how one mountain climber had told him that he would under no circumstances spend any time on Ben McDuie alone, even in the daylight. In 1925, Professor Norman Colley revealed the facts concerning his own encounter with the big gray man, which happened in about 1915, or maybe a little earlier. He said, "I was returning from the cairn on the summit in a mist that I began to think I heard something that else other than the sound of my own footsteps. For every few steps I took, I heard a crunch and then another crunch as if something was walking after me but taking steps three or four times the length of my own. I said to myself, this is nonsense. I listened and heard it again, but couldn't see anything in the mist. As I walked on and the eerie crunch-crunch sounded behind him, he said, I was seized with terror and took to my heels, staggering blindly among the boulders for 4 or 5 miles, nearly down to Lothamurchus Forest. Whatever you might make of it, I don't know, but there's something very queer about the top of Ben McDewey, and I won't go back up there by myself. Then we have the story from a man named Alexander Tunian, told about his own encounter with the terrifying thing that lives on the top of Ben McDewey in the 1940s. He said, in October 1943, I spent a 10-day leave climbing alone in the Cairngorms. One afternoon, just as I reached the summit cairn of Ben McDewey, mist swirled across the Larry Garou and enveloped the mountain. The atmosphere became dark and oppressive. A fierce, bitter wind whisked among the boulders, and an odd sound echoed among the mist. Sounded like footsteps. Then another, and another. And a strange shape loomed up and receded and came charging at me. Without hesitation, I whipped out a revolver and fired 3 times at the figure. When it still came on, I turned and... When the creature still came running at him, even after him shooting it 3 times, he turned and tore off down the pass, reaching Glendary in a time that I could never have bettered. You might ask, was it really the Fearless Maror? And frankly, he thought it was. According to cryptozoologist Dr. Carl Shuker, even more incredible, however, was the entire entity reportedly spied one night on Ben McDewey by a friend of climber writer Richard Frary. Having pitched a tent beside the cairn, Frary's friend awoke to see a brown shape standing between his tent and the moon. And as soon as the shape moved away, his friend peered outside the tent, only to discover that just 20 yards away, a great brown creature was swaggering down the hill. Now, he used the word swagger because he said the creature had an air of insolent strength about it, and because it rose slightly from side to side, taking huge, measured steps. He said it looked as if it was covered with shortish brown hair, and its head was disproportionately large, its neck thick and powerful. By the extreme width of its shoulders compared to the relative slimness of its hips, he thought it was probably a male. Now, it didn't resemble an ape. Its hairy arms, though long, were not unduly so. Its carriage was extremely erect. Another story surfaced in 2004 from Tom Robertson, a noted expert on the paranormal phenomena and author of Ghost Hunter, Adventures in the Afterlife. While on Ben McDewey in July 2004, Robertson and a colleague had a nerve-jangling experience at an altitude of about 4,000 feet. It was about 1 in the morning after we climbed into our sleeping bags. We heard the footsteps of something coming to the tent and heard mumbling sounds outside. I looked through the air vent in the roof and saw a huge arm crashing down. The figure of what seemed like a Yeti was standing over the tent, and all hell broke loose and it was trying to get at us. I remember something landing on my foot. My toes are black, kind of bruised. I've never been so scared in my life than I've been in all the 60 years I've been interested in strange things. I don't know what it is, but it isn't human. It could be the gray man or something from outer space. You just never know. Well, we're going to talk more about the big gray man and his cousins in tomorrow's show. But for now, we've come to the end of our time. So until tomorrow at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.